Hey everyone, this is the Cool for Thought podcast, and I'm Areeb Khan. This is part one of what'll be our 2016 coverage. In this series, you'll hear from a range of people who've studied politics and follow it religiously so that you don't have to. You can turn on the news network of your choice, but you won't find politics talk like this anywhere else. With us today to break down what's been going on the Democratic side are Fritz Bondua and Alberto Morales. Alberto is a Georgetown grad from the south side of Chicago with roots originally in Mexico. He's done great work with undergraduates in DC, helping first-generation college students graduate from college, and is a member of Phi Iota Alpha. He's currently at Brown University getting his master's in public affairs, specializing in education. Fritz is a University of Virginia graduate who's also getting his master's at Brown in public affairs, specializing in urban policy. He's done research with some amazing professors, and one day soon will be changing economic policy in this country. Thanks a lot for being on with us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us also.
So, a couple weeks ago, you guys kind of joked about how Alberto, among you two, Alberto is the liberal Dem, capital D, and Fritz, you are the moderate or kind of conservative Democrat. can you guys explain that a little bit?
I think that we appreciate each other because we both have different views in the way that we want to analyze and construct policy, and I think that's helpful for both of us because we really dig deep into what we're learning about and chatting about and dissecting at the time.
Yeah, I think one of the conversations we often have is about who's more liberal and who's more conservative in terms of being a Democrat. And I think it's actually an interesting conversation in a sense that moving forward, I think our generation will have to deal with that. There will be people who are Republicans but socially liberal. There are people who are Democrat but socially conservative, and vice versa. And I think it's a definitely important conversation to have. But I think it also shows how diverse our generation is becoming. So I think that's
do you think we're reaching a point where society is becoming more like that? We're seeing more Republicans who are socially liberal and more Democrats who are.
Yeah, I think more people in our generation are definitely going to be socially liberal.
Okay.
I think whether you're Republican or Democrat, more people will be socially liberal. And I think there will be very small percentage who will still be socially conservative, whether you're a Democrat or Republican.
Okay. So then why do you guys fall where you do? Alberto, like I was mentioning, like, you know, we kind of refer to you as the liberal Democrat. So why do you categorize yourself as a liberal Democrat?
Yeah, and I think to piggyback a little bit on what Fritz was saying and then to contextualize us a little bit within the millennial generation, if you look at our values, we are a really accepting generation in terms of LGBTQ rights, in terms of immigration, economic policy, you name it. And I think a good case in point is Bernie Sanders and the way that he's polling with the millennial generation. He has a strong lead against Hillary Clinton with our generation for those reasons. And I think it will definitely be something that policy makers in the future will have to be really cognizant of as we continue to grow older and continue to take helm of these positions of power. And for the question that you asked about how we differ, I think we've definitely had heated debates more than one time about certain issues, whether it's immigration, marriage equality, you name it, because of the way that we believe policy should be shaped and how we got there. And I think for me personally, I think that it's been a process of evolvement that began in college and really took place and grew its as a seed from there at Georgetown, because I had the experience of being a student in DC and understanding policy is one thing from the academic side, but then witnessing it firsthand in the nation's capital at an institution that is so strongly oriented in social justice and in faith and in pluralism, I think provided such a diverse learning perspective. So I had the opportunity to learn from so many classmates, and I think I learned the most from my peers and my class for that reason. And I feel like I can channel them whenever I think of different issues, and I think that has really opened my mind and grounded me in where I stand right now politically.
And Fritz, why would you be considered the more moderate Democrat?
I think it has a lot to do with the way I was raised. I think it also has a lot to do with my family background. Mm-hmm.
So how has that influenced like specific policy positions?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very religious conservative family background. My parents, my parents are from Cameroon. A small country in Central Africa that borders Nigeria. I moved to the United States when I was 8 years old in 2001. So we grew up in a very conservative household in terms of social policy, whether it be gay rights, whether it be marriage equality, whether it be abortion, whether it be transgender. So coming from that kind of background, I think we were taught certain values, certain beliefs, certain way of thinking, and you bring those values into college, and you bring those values into your own world.
Right.
So have I moved on those issues? I think I've definitely moved on the left on a lot of those issues.
Okay.
In my own growth, I think also a lot to do with spending time with Birdo, as I call him, Birdo, this year. I think he has really sort of challenged me to actually think about these ideas in a different kind of way, and actually try to think for myself.
Would you feel like you've retained some of that conservatism? Because I feel like, and this is something that we've talked about recently as well. The difference between being a Democrat and a Republican or being liberal or a conservative, because a lot of people associate being conservative with being Republican and being liberal with being Democrat. So if somebody just, if we were to take a snippet of what you just said, right, like your sentence about values and stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. They would think that you're Republican, right?
And he's by far not a Republican.
Exactly. Like, you're probably one of the strongest Democrats that I've ever met, right?
So, yeah, I think that's, people don't really understand sort of the dynamics of those terms. And at least the way I understand those terms, Democrat, when I think of Democrat and Republican, I think of economic policies. I think of economic issues. I think that's how at least I come to understand being a Democrat or Republican. Mm-hmm. And when I think of either being a liberal or conservative, I more so think of social issues. Okay. So I'm definitely, there's no question about me being a Democrat in terms of economic issues. So for me, Democrat means having government involved. It means having government involved in the economy. It means regulation on Wall Street. It means it means healthcare. It means actually sort of government providing, so government trying to provide healthcare for people. It means that the government provides safety, economic safety nets for people who may fall in hard times. But for me, social and in terms of social issues, then those become marriage equality, transgender rights, abortion. I think those are social issues, and that's when you're either liberal or conservative.
Okay.
But when it comes to economic issues, I think I understand that as being a Democrat, do you want the government involved in economic issues, or do you not want the government involved in the economic policy of the country?
See, I just find this conversation really funny because I think this really puts into perspective what our generation has to put up with in comparison to older generations, because we bucket issues so easily in order to kind of get an idea of who a person is, whether it's socially, politically, you name it. And the data is out there. We even take in political affiliation and who we want to date and who we don't want to date.
Yeah,
and we've become such a polarized society. And I think although we are progressive in social policy as a millennial generation, we, I think, are backwards in so many different ways compared to the older generations because we've been bucketed.
Then speaking of, now that you mentioned older generations, the debates. So the three candidates we've got on stage, they're of a very different generation. Talking about liberal democratic politics, modern democratic politics, where do you see these candidates falling in line going forward for our generation, especially coming out of the debates, like seeing the things that they've said, hearing, you know, Hillary Clinton kind of finally say things like Black Lives Matter, you know, being pushed into, you know, areas that are going to catch our generation's attention, you know, how do you guys take the debates then?
Well, first and foremost, before I even address that, I think it's worth the plug to remind our viewers and listeners that I think we are also confronting issues as a Democratic Party. And a good example is the fact that the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, has chosen tactfully to only have 6 debates instead of the 22 that were held in 2012. And I think there are a plethora of articles that our listeners can go and find and figure out as to why. But I think it's really a disservice to our generation and the millennial generation for us to not have more debates and really get to know the candidates. And I think for us who are studying policy, it's very easy to catch on to the issues because we are experts in many ways, because we have been following this through our undergrad lives and now more intensely in the graduate coursework. But for people who are not as aware and acutely watching, I think it's very tumultuous and confusing, and all they have is sound bites and don't know how to dissect their policies by just going online. So I think it's just very disappointing that the DNC chose to limit debates, and then in subsequent to that, have them on Saturdays, on the weekends, at really obscure hours where people are tired.
Even doing NFL playoff
exactly games. Like during NFL playoff games was the last one, right?
Yeah. So whenever I chat with anybody about my views of the 2016 election, I'm always sure to mention that and just like show that we are very disappointed with the way that the Democratic Party, the one who is supposed to be the leader in advocacy for the Democrats, by them purposely limiting debates is just counterintuitive to their mission, in my opinion.
I think looking at the candidates, at least the Democratic candidates this year, starting with, I think, Hillary, I'm just baffled. I'm just completely baffled of how she is continuing to struggle with winning a simple Democratic nomination. I mean, last time in 2008, she was the prohibitive favorite. And I think she didn't take President Obama seriously.
Right.
And she got shellacked. And I think this year again, I think she came. I mean, we saw the first 2 debates. She was, or at least the first 3 debates, she was taking her sweet old time. She was going to taking bathroom breaks, having a good time, doing her usual big laugh. And I think she has gotten a rude awakening once again.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand how someone who has been in public life for over 40 years, I mean, served as First Lady of Arkansas, First Lady of the United States, Secretary of State, ran, this is her second presidential election, and a senator from New York, and her husband was a former president, he knew how to do it right. I'm just baffled at how she can't get it right, and I'm just starting to wonder whether she even has the political the if factor to actually get elected. Okay. She comes off as very inauthentic.
Mm-hmm.
She comes off as very rehearsed.
Yeah, this is where I want to like add to like what he said. I think Fritz and I have multiple debates about her authenticity, a good point that you raised this week actually that like I agree with was the fact that we are so quick to vilify her for looking really disingenuous and not gregarious and authentic and just like the person that you want to have a beer with, the politician who can
like
do
that
it.
SNL skit.
Yeah, just like the person who can do it all, right? I know I'm wickedly smart. I know that I can also like nuke you if I have to because I have access to the codes, but I can't make you laugh because I'm not funny. And we vilify her so quickly. And I think you made a great point this week to me when you said, well, you know what? What if that's just who she is? Yeah. She's always been pre-professional, even since high school. And all of us just want to imagine this super outgoing politician who can make you laugh. But at the same time, is that what we really should be striving for?
Yeah.
For all we know, this woman is actually who she is on the debate floor.
That might just be her.
She's just boring.
Yeah, that might just be her. You're very right. No, I agree. I think it's... But But knowing our generation, knowing the
we don't want that.
We don't want that.
And we want someone who's ratchet,
charismatic. So I mean, so especially coming off Obama for 8 years and coming off Michelle Obama for 8 years, you just can't. We just can't imagine going back to someone who's very basic
and dry
and dry.
Even, I wouldn't say basic. I would say dry.
I mean basic in terms of personality, not basic in terms of her intellect. I think she's very smart.
Yeah, and also we're like asking a lot if this woman who I forget her age right now,
68.
Yeah, close to 70. We expect her to like know how to Snapchat. Yeah,
pay really? Attention. Use hashtags.
But Joe Biden. But someone like VP Joe Biden is good at it. Yeah, someone like her husband is good at it. She just doesn't have it.
That's true.
But I think it's unfortunate that we rely so much on personality. Like politics is so personality driven, but I think it's and I think it will hurt her.
But
it
really
will
just
I think to her campaign, they've tried to saw her as someone who's really personable, and she's been really eager to take selfies now, and she's been taking selfies with Kim Kardashian to show her appeal to the younger generations. But I think another way to like frame her, to make her, to actually show like and like showcase who she is by actually having intimate conversations with her closest friends in videos and saying, oh, well, this is actually who Hillary's been her entire life. She's been very serious. Mm-hmm. She's always been the straight A student. She's always been prepared. She's worked so assiduously to get to where she is. And she's a little bit more serious than us, but that's how she's gotten ahead. Mm-hmm. I think that would sell more than this fake image that they're trying to sell.
I agree, because we just know it comes up as very
because if I saw her friends vouch for her, her teachers, maybe even Yale law professors just show who she was in her character at a younger age and how she's always been this serious personality, I think that would be more validating to me and say, oh, well, I guess she's boring, but I guess that's who she's been in her entire life. She's just not calculating.
Right, yeah. Right.
But then I guess we're going into a branding issue, but who knows? Maybe we will never know true politicians. Let's be real.
I wish you could talk a little bit. You mentioned something we were having a conversation over the weekend about how, like, as a people, we want integrity from our politicians. Like, we want them to come off as very natural, as very, they have a lot of integrity, but politics itself is not, it's all about lying and
about getting in the mud.
It's a really catch 22 for me because this field is a field, it's a sector of values in many ways. It's what you're selling. You're selling your integrity to the public, right? It can't be quantified. There's no numerical value. There's no integrity score like your credit score.
Yeah.
Thank God there's not. But that's what we're basically selling people on, is this integrity score that we want to put people on a pedestal because in many ways we imagine them as a Jesus because they are the ones who shape our society, and that's a little bit problematic because at the end of the day, you really dig deep into the sector and it's a lot of mudslinging. It's not what they preach in any way. So I don't know. I think thinking about our generation, I'm excited to see when we grow older how our generation is going to change that field because we are a little bit more aware that you don't have to be cookie cutter and perfect to be in policy because it would be a mistake. Because there's Snapchats who will catch you at this point. Mm-hmm. They didn't have Instagram. They didn't have Facebook. Mm-hmm. They didn't have tweets. All of that will be a trail for our generation. We have yet to see. We have yet to see how that's going to play out.
Very true.
We
have yet to see it.
Getting back to just the numbers a little bit, like you guys mentioned, the comparison between the maybe complete opposite of genuine Hillary Clinton is Bernie Sanders, right? So Bernie Sanders is this guy who looks like a different politician on TV. Looks and sounds like
doesn't
a different
look very
person.
Good.
He kind of seems like, you know.
Like you want to hug him.
But what I think I've enjoyed seeing over the course of like the debates is kind of the progression of somebody like Bernie Sanders saying, "Oh, you know, Hillary Clinton is my friend. You know, I don't want to attack her." He kind of said that repeatedly, right? But then nowadays you see in any interview he does, even just on Meet the Press this past weekend, he says every single answer he mentions Hillary Clinton.
Man.
And while that's not an attack, right, it's more of like, oh, well, this is what she's saying, but this is what I'm saying. This is why what I'm saying is better, right? And I wanted to go through the poll number that I saw today that just came out from ABC was that Bernie Sanders is leading Hillary Clinton, I believe, 60-33
in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire,
you're just killing her.
And so now, you know, we see Clinton also kind of pushing back on that from talking as if she was just the presumptive nominee and not really having to address having any other opponents to now really having to, you know, fight back against Bernie Sanders on something like healthcare, on something like guns. You know, there's a direct correlation between those two, right? It's like you said, like Obama all over again, right?
Yeah, it's and I think Bernie, I think we're seeing this transformation from Bernie, because I actually think he's actually thinking that he can win.
Yeah,
I think when he got into it, he wanted to actually really push Hillary
to keep her
left, or to the left.
That's kind of how I saw it. Yeah,
but I think he's like, well, geez, I can win this shit, and
just like Donald Trump, I'm sure.
No, same thing, Bernie. And he's like, oh, I can't. I think he's like, not only am I going to go after her, policy, whether it is on healthcare, whether it is economic, whether it's taking money from Goldman Sachs, whether it's even going after her husband, calling his action deplorable. I mean, I think he actually is starting to believe that he can actually win. But even before we get into that, I want you to talk about what you mentioned, that Bernie is doing something that's unheard of. He's essentially a socialist, sort of, running for office and getting all these votes. And you talked about how only a white man can pull that off.
Yeah, I chatted with Fritz last week about this, how we glorify Bernie Sanders for being so progressive in his values and being a self-described socialist, democratic socialist. And in his speech at Georgetown University, he basically delineated what it meant for him to have that title. And it was a great speech. I encourage everybody to listen to it. Not because it's my alma mater by any means, but he just happened to give it there. But it was a great speech. It was the only one that he's actually really described what it means for him to be a democratic socialist. And then in it, he describes his intense views on income inequality. It's just a really poignant discussion. But at the same time, I can't imagine a Latino, a Muslim,
a
Barack Obama in 2008 being the nominee after describing himself as a democratic socialist. Yeah. There is a lot of white privilege associated with that.
Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, if we did have Barack Obama, if we had Deval Patrick running in this election, and if he was any more liberal than Hillary Clinton was, right?
Even Hillary would not be able to do that.
I believe that too, yeah. So we've kind of done that thing already, you know, maybe like 15, 20 minutes into this episode, where we've only talked about the front runners, right? We've only talked about Clinton. We've only talked about Sanders. Mm. And while, you know, it may not be an issue for our listeners, how do you think Martin O'Malley feels about that?
I actually like Martin O'Malley. I think he's, I like his policy. He's more liberal than Hillary, but not as liberal as Senator Sanders. He did a great job. I mean, not too bad in Maryland. He was all right as a mayor of Baltimore. I think there are a lot of black folks who have a lot to say about his.
I would say there are a lot of minorities who disagree with that. Yeah.
But I don't think his policies are bad. I actually like the guy. I like the fact that he pushes and he sort of needles at Hillary all the time.
He seems a little robotic to me too.
Oh my!
Mentioned Hillary Clinton, right?
There we go. Yeah. And I think Berto can talk a little bit more about that. But he's just the reason he's not gaining any traction is just because he's very robotic. Yeah. He comes off as very rehearsed. He comes up not even rehearsed, because if it was rehearsed, it would come out.
It would
perfectly
actually sound so much better.
I'm being serious. So he just needs to
memorize his points.
He's just very unelectable. So I think that's his biggest downfall.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, he's worse than Sarah Palin. I'm being serious. Like, he is worse than... At least Sarah Palin, the shit that came out of her mouth was crazy, right? It came out... The shit that came...
Mean delivery-wise.
Let's
be clear.
At least the delivery was, like, on point. At least the delivery made sense. It was, like, it was flowing.
Yeah.
He's just bad. And I'm like, you served as governor of a huge state and mayor of a huge city, and you're having trouble in a debate?
Well, a politically important state, maybe, and not a huge
liberal
state. Yeah.
I just can't. He has not even improved one bit. Not one. I'm blown.
I think it's a shame that I think his delivery has set him back so much, because I do believe that he is a genuine candidate that actually wants to improve people's lives. And when looking at my candidates, who I look to and who will vouch and fight for the Latino community, I think that he's one of the front runners that I really wish would actually pull higher, because he's been very consistent with the Latino communities on immigration, on economic policies, on housing policies. He's just been the one who has been consistent since becoming a high profile official in Maryland, and I just wish that our generation got to know that a little better. And it's unfortunate that we haven't, because I think a poll released today polled him at 1%, and that's not the top 1% that we're talking about.
So do you think that the inevitability of a Hillary Clinton nomination plays a factor in us only seeing three candidates? You know, I mean, like I mentioned, somebody like Deval Patrick. I know, Fritz, you're an Elizabeth Warren fan.
Yeah, I love that woman.
Yeah, see, so do you think the idea that, oh, you know, Clinton's just going to win the nomination, do you think that hurt in seeing different candidates?
Yeah, I mean, I love Elizabeth Warren. My theory for why Elizabeth Warren didn't run was because I don't think she wants to run against a woman.
Okay.
I didn't think she wants, like...
Any woman, but Hillary Clinton.
And I just don't think she wants to pit two women against each other. I think she would have wiped the floor with Hillary. But that's just my particular personal opinion. But politics is one of those fields or industry where experience matters, or where people are rewarded for their experience.
Right.
And I just felt like the Democratic Party were like, Hillary, it's your turn.
Yeah.
And I felt like in 2008, they felt like it was her turn, but Obama just swept her over her feet. And I just feel like this year they were like, it was hush hush.
Yeah.
Hillary, it's your turn. Yeah. Let's back off.
So would you say that it's hurting the party then? The inevitability?
I think absolutely. I think it's definitely hurting the party, She should have been, because of Bernie, maybe not so much as her in the party, because he's actually really challenging her.
And like you mentioned, pushing her.
He's pushing her, and he can actually, I mean, when you're pulling him against Donald Trump, he's actually has higher numbers against Donald than Hillary. So it's not the worst thing.
Which is something that people don't really know, what you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Because people generally think that, once Hillary Clinton is the nominee, there's no Republican who can beat her. Mm-hmm. But like you just mentioned, right, Bernie Sanders is polling better against the presumptive GOP nominee right now, right?
Yeah.
So kind of going back to, you know, what we talked about earlier with young people being, or naturally more inclined to being liberal, what do you guys think is the biggest selling point for the Democratic Party? Mm. Especially considering the fact that you guys do differ on issues. How do you bring somebody into the Democratic Party?
Well, I think I will not give any endorsements, because I myself have yet to decide who I will be voting for. It's very much a process for me, and I think it should be very much a process for our listeners as well. And I encourage everybody to follow the debates as much as they can. But what I will say is that I think the choice is very clear for me, and there is no other option in 2016 than a Democrat in the White House. I don't want to see a Republican enter the White House for the reasons and their policies that they've mentioned. There is not one substantive policy measure that I can be confident in the Republican candidates that I can say and raise my American flag and say I'm proud to have elected and inaugurate this Republican president. Donald Trump, mass deportations, you name it. It's not even worth going through the policies, because it just gets me mad and my blood boiling.
And sorry for stopping you in that. But I would want to mention that it's not just Donald Trump, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, we see Donald Trump on TV every day. And I mean, you know, it's kind of like easy to say that now he's kind of just saying outlandish things just to get more attention. But I think the deeper lying issue there is that we have other Republican candidates who are actually kind of for the same policies.
No, for sure. And I only mention them because he's the opposite extreme of Bernie Sanders. But for sure, and I think a good example is today, Marco Rubio released a statement after SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, finally decided to hear out the rulings on DACA and THAPA. Mm-hmm. And
can you explain what those are too, by the way?
Sure. It's deferred actions for childhood arrivals and deferred actions for parents of Americans. And it's an executive action that Barack Obama signed in order to provide deportation relief to immigrant children and families who are not priorities in deportations, aka not criminals. And the policies have the potential to impact 5 million people and 5 million lives by not being deported and providing a work permit. So it was taken up to the courts, and today, thankfully, the Supreme Court decided to listen to the case. So there will be the case will be heard on in April, and then the ruling will come out later this summer. And Marco Rubio, who has been in the past a strong supporter of immigration reform, he was one of the co-sponsors and writers for the immigration bill that ultimately failed, has now backtracked. And today he said that if he were president, he would immediately eliminate DACA and DAPA through executive action. So, no, you're right. You're completely right. And when you look at the candidates, it's very, very clear that all of them are not too far from Donald Trump. And I would encourage the listeners to pay close attention, not just to the Democratic elections, which are very important, because we assume that the party is the, well, and the nominee will ultimately end up being president, but there's a high probability that he or she may not. And
yeah.
And for that reason, I think that I encourage our listeners to listen to the other side, just to hear what they have to say, because we disregard them and say, oh, they're crazy, they're never going to get elected, but it's just
can. But Republicans
yeah, but
have
possibly
been elected, right?
Yeah.
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 Okay. Well, you know, so we talk about, you know, Sanders pushing Clinton to the left. We talk about you know, the Democratic debates in general actually having a little bit more substance now. Do you see this carrying over long term? Do you see the like substantive policy issues that like somebody like Bernie Sanders are bringing up? Do you see them actually, you know, like I said, carrying through forward? Like if Hillary Clinton is nominated or is elected president, does she care about those issues? Does the Democrat, and I don't mean that specifically to her. I mean, does the Democratic Party.
That's a great question.
Yeah. Going forward, are they really about that life?
And the way I would answer that question, like if we were speaking to like our generation, I think it really depends on what kind of Democratic Party we have. And when I mean, do we have a Sanders-type Democratic Party, or do we have a Hillary, Obama, sort of the establishment moderate Democratic Party?
And sorry to cut you off. I would argue that the Democratic Party is as establishment-oriented, if not more, than the Republicans.
They are. And I think Obama has done a great job with concerning all the things he has had to deal with, especially with the Republican Party trying to block everything he passes. But the Democratic Party, like the establishment, the Democratic Party is not that much different in terms of its policies.
Right. It also doesn't look very different.
It doesn't look very different. Hillary. Yeah. It's a borderline conservative. Hillary is a borderline. It's moderate.
And then racially.
It's even social policy. Just a few years ago, she became for gay rights.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 90s, she was vehemently against gay. She was like, marriages between a man and a woman. And you even see her economic policy. It's not very progressive.
Yeah.
You see where she gets her campaign finance from. It's not very progressive. I think it truly depends. Obviously, having a Hillary in office is a lot better than having any Republican, though. But to think that it's going to be totally different,
I think we're
sadly mistaken.
I saw a video on Twitter the other day of Hillary Clinton giving a speech. I don't remember. It was mid-90s. She's talking about the drug issue. You know, at the last debate, she mentioned drug issue. Or, you know, we were talking about the drug issue and...
her husband was one of the toughest people in the war on drugs.
Exactly.
The worst.
Exactly. And the worst. In the video, in the speech, she's talking about how the people who are involved in even petty drug crimes, how they're immoral, they have no conscience, they're violent offenders against society. And now, you know, my argument would be that now that the drug issue has affected the white community as much as, if not more, than minorities. Definitely not more. Mm-hmm. So now that it's affecting white communities, you know, we see it as a health issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a very distinct difference in, you know, I mean, if somebody were to watch that video and then were to watch her talk on the debate stage the other day, you'd say, well, this isn't the same person, like you mentioned on other issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's done that a lot.
Yeah, I just think she's sitting there like, oh, where's the country?
Yeah.
At? Oh, let me be there.
But that's the thing, that we've praised her inconsistency almost. Like, we've praised the fact that she has quote-unquote evolved. So Mitt Romney's a flip-flopper, but Hillary Clinton is a progressive who evolves and you know, changes with the times.
And I think there's a huge huge difference between a flip-flopper and someone who evolved. Whether you actually believe the person evolved, and do we actually believe Hillary has evolved? I mean, in our hearts and hearts, probably, like most, probably we don't know her, but
yeah,
just from the outside, we don't. Like, we just like she's moving on.
Yeah,
but I think
wind is moving.
I think a lot of this has to be with how adroit they are politically. I think Mitt Romney was foolish to be such a flip flopper across states, knowing that he was being recorded, and then it was very easy to call him out on his flip floppingness. Hillary, quote-unquote, evolves, aka you can call it flip-flops, over time, but yet is consistent during an election. So she's not. So she's able to use that really tactfully because she's not flip-flopping in between an election, where Mitt Romney was.
Well, Mitt Romney had to. I mean, there's no way you win a Republican primary being a moderate.
I mean,
we
all remember the Etch-a-Sketch quote. Right?
Yeah.
He has no choice. Unfortunately, there's no way.
On the flip side, then, you know, we talk about the inconsistency with Clinton. I think a lot of the consistency that we see with Bernie Sanders isn't having the effect that he thought it would. You know, putting out the videos of him in like the 70s or the 80s saying the exact same things, the calls for equality, as great as they may be, and they were, absolutely. I think a lot of the times his consistency actually hurts him on the campaign trail, because I see a lot of people say, I see a lot of people ask questions like, let's take Black Lives Matter, for example. Mm-hmm. He couldn't really, in the beginning at least, he couldn't really conceptualize this movement because he only saw it as an economic argument, right?
He didn't.
Yeah.
That was really problematic. I remember that because he talked about how in order to save black lives and improve black life communities, he, I think, addressed it in a really economic lens. He said, we need to increase incomes and then provide higher paying jobs. But I'm sorry, Sandra Bland's mobility and her bachelor did not prevent her from being arrested and then eventually killed. In a jail cell, her mobility and her economic standpoint did not spare her life.
Yes.
And I think it just shatters the notion that Bernie Sanders is in line with Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people on my own Facebook feed comment on how, why are Black Lives Matter rallying at a Bernie Sanders event? You know, why are they protesting Bernie Sanders? Why are they protesting, liberal? Can you guys explain that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think we chatted about this a lot, and a lot of people were like, oh, well, aren't they preaching to the choir in many ways by just attacking the candidates? But we have seen it unfold and the power that organizing has in national debates and why it's crucial that our generation is heavily involved. And we, for many reasons, are attacked for being entitled, etc. But I think when you look at the data, we're also politically unengaged.
Yeah.
And that frightens me as a generation.
Yeah.
That we're not caring about these issues as they unfold. And Black Lives Matter just shows the potential of what our generation can do when we inject ourselves in the political process and what it means to have that part of the conversation. And I've seen how these candidates have now shifted the way that they talk about race and income in their conversations, and I hear the word black and Latino thrown out more, even if it might just be a buzzword for them. At least it's now in their mention of the sentence. And a good example of that is how Hillary Clinton mentioned Flint, Michigan,
and talked
about poverty and how if it were rich suburban rich kids, we'd be really upset and doing something, but because it's affecting black income, low income communities, we're not rushing to fix the problem. And just that, I think, is worth celebrating. And I attribute that to our generation's strong advocacy through Black Lives Matter, because I shudder to think of what the alternative would have been. And I wonder if she would have been so vocal on race and that Flint closing like argument.
Yeah.
And I think for, in terms of Black Lives, I think for years the Democratic Party has just been very comfortable with Black people.
Oh, exactly.
They have just known, like, we're going to get the Black vote.
We'll get the minority votes. We're just going to get the Black vote. Yeah.
They never had to work for it. And I love the fact that Black Lives Matter
and
is
they,
pushing.
Yeah, exactly. They forced them and they said,
like,
you know,
no guarantee.
Yeah, if you want our votes, you have to pay attention
to
us.
To attention.
And it's the first time that that's happened.
Mm-hmm. And that's why it's even more important that we vote and show power in numbers, because we get ignored and we get thrown in the back burner. And that's something that I am very passionate about, is and then specifically speaking about the Latino community, the Latino vote is always fetishized, and like it's always called the sleeping giant, because it's something that we have yet to like amass in power with our numbers. But I mean, it's only a matter of time before our generation continues to like grow that, and it's important that we like keep the momentum, because if not, it just goes to show you that if we don't make noise, we will be ignored. And that's something that I've learned in higher education. If there's anything that I learned as an administrator, is that if you do not ask for it, if you do not advocate for it, if you do not make noise for it, if you do not organize, you will not get anything. And that is very true to policy and politics.
Yeah. And my biggest fear for actually Democrats in 2016 is that we won't get the same turnout that we got for Barack Obama. In terms of, I'm fearful that Black people are not going to, because Black people came out in record numbers.
Yeah.
That ain't happening. But I'm just fearful that those numbers will drop so much. I'm fearful that young people may not come out as much, especially if it's like, they love Bernie, but let's say it's Hillary.
Uh-huh.
And he's killing her in terms of young people, so they may not come out as much. I think we're the Republicans have been successful in winning general elections, and people always like, this country's majority liberal, but how do Republicans often get back in the White House? It's because they count on us not to vote, and we repeatedly don't vote. Because the majority of their populace are older people, white people, and older white people always will vote.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm really fearful about, that we just won't turn out and they will win.
Yeah.
I think that's my concern.
I wanted to talk about, you know, policy agendas and things like that a little bit more in depth. And like you mentioned with, you know, electability and stuff, I think it's really easy for people who study politics to say, you know, when the country is, you know, at war or when we're being attacked or whatever, you know, foreign policy wise, we always want a strong leader. And so a strong leader usually ends up becoming the Republican, right? Because the Republican Party is so much better at
being hawkish.
What I would call fear-mongering,
mm-hmm.
others would call being hawkish, right? And so, you know, we see foreign policy now with, like you mentioned, Trump being really the megaphone on these issues.
Yep.
And we see the Democrats kind of, on that same issue on foreign policy, also kind of saying the same things, really, besides maybe Martin O'Malley, because I haven't heard much on foreign policy from him, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but
I haven't heard much from him
in general, right?
Unfortunately.
Do you think this is an election where we want a strong candidate, where we want, you know, the tough guy, we want the macho Republican, we want Trump who's in your face and will tell you that we're going to make America great again? Or do you think that this is an election where we're really looking at the social impacts?
I think if you want to win the general election and you're a Democrat, you have got to come out tough in terms of foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're going to pursue that or not,
mm-hmm.
that's your business. But you have got to come out and say, we're going to go after ISIS, we're going to bomb the hell out of ISIS, we're going to blah blah blah, we're going to fix our borders. I mean, whether you believe it or not, because crazily, like in a weird way, it actually matters in terms of like the American populace,
right?
Because the American populace are actually very fearful.
Just framing yourself as the candidate who's going to.
They're
keep
actually
us safe,
very
yeah.
fearful
yeah.
that people are coming into this country, or that they're very fearful that ISIS is going to bomb somewhere in the United States, or that we're somehow losing our. People are actually very fear in a crazy way. People are actually, and I think if you are a Democratic candidate, you have got to come up and say, okay, I'm going to be tough on foreign policy.
Yeah.
I'm going to go after ISIS. I'm going to continue to defend Israel. I'm going to make sure Iran doesn't get its nuclear. I mean, you just have to come out very tough on ISIS.
So you have to pander.
You have to. You can't be like Rand Paul and come out and say we're lives in fear. You just can't, because the United States will never be a country in which it's not involved in everyone's problem. Because we're the number one country in the world, we're the most powerful country in the world, and we are the world's police, whether we like it or not, and that's never going to change. So just come out and say.
So you think a Democrat still has to stick to that?
I think a Democrat
has to match Republicans.
Of course, I think she's going to come. If Hillary will come off as weak, if she is not tough on foreign policy, she's going to come off as very weak.
And being a woman, of course, plays
off
on
come
that
off
too.
As
I mean,
very
I remember
weak.
I remember a couple of debates ago. It might have been not the last one, but the previous one, when. It was about her relationship with Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And her answer is 9/11.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. So if you're a Democrat, and I'm seeing this from Bernie, but Bernie's also becoming tougher on foreign policy. I mean, he's very on point on message, when was it? Sunday on foreign policy.
Uh-huh.
About going after ISIS, making sure. Uh-huh. I mean, you're just going to have to be tough on that.
Yeah.
Whether that's what you do or not.
Even in the beginning, when you know everybody was saying, "Oh, he's so liberal on every single issue," you know, every single time somebody said that, I said, "Okay, well, let's see how he is on foreign policy. Let's see how he is on defense,"
mm-hmm.
because I think you do kind of have to match the Republicans
mm-hmm.
on being tough, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, one thing that's important to me personally, one issue that's important to me personally, is drones.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very beginning, that's something that, you know, Bernie Sanders said, well, you know, that's a program we're going to continue using if I'm president.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, I don't think I've heard Hillary Clinton mention drones once, but I don't expect her to turn to reverse that program at all.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, is something like that, you know, a program like Obama's drone program, because at this point it really is Obama's drone program.
I mean, he
yeah.
used that thing like
yes.
it's nobody's business.
Do you see in 2017, in 2021, do you see us still using these drones as our main method of international?
Of course. I think if not, we might even get better at using better technology.
Right.
Because as Americans, the Iraq war bled us out, and it taught a lot of Americans, we don't want no boots on the ground. And this is one way of not having boots on the ground and still doing damage.
Right.
And so people don't want boots on the ground. People don't want to send their kids to die. Their men and their daughters and son.
Yeah.
So I think drones, as whatever your opinions are on drones, they do the job. They destroy, and there's no human, at least on our human casualty, at least on our
at least on our end,
at least
but,
on our
but
end. But
thousands
it,
and thousands.
It's a problem. It's
like,
a human rights. It's a human rights issue. No question about it.
Right.
At least the indiscriminate use of throwing or dropping drones on people.
Yeah, and then going back to what you mentioned about Iraq and then how it fits into like them seeming tough, it's a very fine line for the Democratic Party. I think it's easy for the Republicans to just be very hawkish and be fear-mongering. I think that it's expected from them because they don't have the White House right now, so they have the opportunity to attack Barack Obama and his foreign policy. So it's very easy, and I think it would be different if there was a Republican in the White House. I think there would be a little bit, I would imagine, more respect for their foreign policy since it's their party. Nevertheless, when you look at Hillary Clinton, I think it's a fine line that she's going through because she, and you're right, Fritz, there is a lot of fear in the country. And I think it's not unfounded in any way because of Paris, because of the shootings happening across the country. I think I empathize with that in many ways because I myself and like sometimes afraid returning to Chicago with all the violence going on the South Side. I like wonder like one day will I be at the wrong place at the wrong time. So I don't think it's unfounded in any way. But at the same time, Hillary Clinton can't be at the same level that Donald Trump is because then they won't trust her in any way as chief commander, like, because
like she can't come out and say, I'm gonna deport people and I'm gonna build walls. I'm gonna build wall and I'm gonna make Mexico pay for it. She can't come out and
no,
say
no, not
that.
Even that.
But
not
what,
even,
she can't come
not
out.
Even politically. I think what I'm trying to get at is that she has to be seemingly tough, but in a way that doesn't make people feel like she's a hot button, because people don't want to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan and Iraq is still fresh in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to sell herself to the American people in a way that shows that she will stand her ground, but also not inject us in any easy war. So I think that's very different than the Republican Party, because it's a fine line to walk through. And then, like you said, amalgamating the fact that she's a woman, gender is another layer to that.
Mm-hmm.
So she has another pressure to sell the American people as a woman who won't be soft and as a woman who won't be easily pushed around. So she's, I think, done a great job at selling that message, because I know that's maybe one thing that she has been fearful of, and like I think we should, I think, credit her for just getting to this point in her political life as a woman. I think it's something to commend.
On the domestic gun issue, you know, we see President Obama talking about his executive actions now. For some people, you know, going to exclaim, finally, he did something, right? And for others, it's, you know, it's oh my gosh, the government's trying to take all of our guns.
Which is the dumbest thing I've
first,
ever heard.
Okay, so first off, could you guys explain a little bit about what these measures are, or what the Democratic Party is kind of pushing for?
Mm-hmm. I think the party is definitely pushing for common sense gun laws in terms of strict background.
Okay, and so we hear the term. Sorry, we hear the term common sense gun laws a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? So
it's one of those buzzwords.
Yeah. So is that just background checks?
It's not only background checks. It's like you don't need to have military style weapons. Like you don't. It should be difficult to purchase military style weapons. Whether it is AK-47, whether it is
AR-15,
or having the ability to buy multiple rounds.
Uh-huh.
So when Obama talks about common sense guns law, he's talking about tough background checks. He's talking about removing military style weapons at least from the streets or from easily being accessible to anybody,
mm-hmm.
But he's still protecting people who want to have guns for hunting, for hunting and going out and hunting games.
Yeah.
So that's what he means. So when he's talking about coming, he's not saying that.
Well, I think it's also worth like actually talking about what the executive action is, and it's a 4-pronged approach. It's
mm-hmm.
keeping guns out of the wrong hands through background checks. And I have the executive action here pulled up to just like provide a little bit more context. Make our community safer from gun violence through effective enforcement, gun theft tracking, domestic abuse outreach. 3, increasing mental health treatment and reporting it in background checks through healthcare access, information sharing. And then the cool one that I think is innovative and I am excited to see where this leads is the 4th one. And it's shape the future of gun safety technology through research and development and technical collaboration. So that does not in any way read you are not allowed to buy a gun.
To purchase a firearm.
Yeah.
So then why do you think, because the NRA, I mean, you guys know where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the NRA was pro-background check before they were anti-background check, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why is the Republican Party right now pushing so hard against these quote-unquote common sense gun laws?
Because, I mean, we talked about it. I mean, the gun sales have increased during Obama's administration.
I mean, after the executive...
It has increased.
Yeah.
And I think the majority of gun owners or the majority of gun manufacturers are Republicans and belong to the NRA. And the less background checks, the more... I think it's a simple supply and demand. It's a simple economic... It's like it has nothing to do with any moral issue.
Yeah.
They're just trying to make money. It has nothing to do with the amendment. They're just making a lot of money selling guns.
So basically you think that the Republican politicians are just kind of up there saying, oh, we can't have these because they just want to sell more guns.
Yeah, and these people are bankrolling their campaigns. I don't think there's any...
Yeah.
Big idea behind
it. I think one of the things that the Republicans do when talking about mental health, I think it's used as a little bit of a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you guys, I think you guys will agree with me on this too.
I think it's when it's a young white man who goes around shooting right. People, it's a mental health issue.
Yes.
It's we need to focus on mental health. We need to make sure people have, but we don't give the same type of privilege to whether it's a young man of color, whether Latino or black or any other young man of color who goes around, maybe engages, who joins a gang or who may commit murder because he was peer pressured into joining a gang. But we don't say, maybe he has any mental health. Maybe his mother wasn't at home. Maybe his father was never there. Maybe his mom is on drugs. I mean, his community is just jacked up. I would assume that when you're dealing with all of those, you're very angry. You're an angry young man, and those are mental issues.
And you probably need some mental health services.
You need some mental health services to go through those, to process that anger.
So, yeah, and I call mental health the scapegoat because I think, you know, after all of these shootings, we see Republicans say, and Democrats, we see all politicians really say, you know, oh my God, it's such a such a heinous act.
Mm-hmm.
Can't understand why somebody would commit this. We need more mental health treatment, and then they cut mental health funding.
Exactly, right? and if you need look no further than Rahm Emanuel in Chicago,
exactly, yes,
because he has dramatically reduced the mental health facilities in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now, I guess, kind of switching gears. One criticism of the Democratic Party, I think a lot of the times, is their policy on taxes. Just in general, the economics. From Republicans, a lot of the criticism is, why do you just want to take my money? You just want to tax me immensely so that the government can provide all of these things. That's a bad thing, apparently. How do you guys see the debt, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of debt? How do you guys see the Democratic Party tackling that?
Well, before I get into that, I think that there's this meme that I saw in light of the Powerball that none of us won, unfortunately.
I wouldn't be, you don't know.
That's true, but I would not be here. I'll let you know that today.
There is this great meme that read, let's just keep spiraling the Powerball until it hits $11 trillion and the U.S. can pay off its debt.
That'd be good. Yeah, that'd be nice, actually. Ironic thing is, you know, you'd be taking money from the poor, right?
Yeah. So we, yet again, use the poor to pay off our debt.
Yes, exactly.
Which isn't too far stretch from what we're doing right now.
I think people need to be taxed. I'm all for fair taxes. I'm all for tax based on how much you make. And I think if you make more money in this country, you need to be taxed more to help those who don't make as much money, to provide programs for those who don't do as well.
Yeah.
And I think actually right now, the way the tax system is set up with all these different loopholes, it benefits the rich because they can get out these, they can get out these taxes.
Right.
And
so explain that a little bit. So, I mean, you know, that's something that we hear a lot, whether it's in a debate from Bernie Sanders.
And to his credit, he's done a great job to highlighting the issue.
Yeah. Like I mentioned, he's been consistent on that.
I don't even know how to. It's like there's just so many things. Like they can, like rich people can, wealthy people can open up these shell companies.
Okay.
They can open up a shell company where there's just one person.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're the only employee and the employer, and a shell company in some country outside the U.S. And then say, they have a company, and they can even labor as a nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
and then get
and avoid paying taxes,
avoid paying taxes
like that, right?
Or they can, there are these things where you give donations, or you give big contributions to charities, and you avoid paying taxes. I mean, it goes on and on of different ways that we middle class people can actually just get out these loopholes,
right? So now, talking about immigration, Berto, I think that this is a personal topic for you, maybe. I mean, it definitely also
get
is for me. Actually, it should be for all three of us, right? I mean, we're all children of immigrants.
Yeah.
Fritz, you are an immigrant.
I'm an immigrant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we see the rhetoric, like we mentioned on the GOP side, you know, the bombastic nature of, you know, build a wall and make Mexico pay for it.
Which is
11 million, you know, self-deport, you know, all this stuff. So where do the Democrats stand on immigration?
Mm-hmm.
Not strong enough. And the fact that no question in Sunday's debate, which just happened, were asked on immigration is so problematic. And how can we trust the Democratic Party to actually uphold its values of changing broken systems that are fractured, if they can't even give airtime to discussing how they would differ on their policies should they be elected. And for a population of people, it's not a small margin by any means. It's 11 million people who are affected. It's 11 million people who are living in the shadows, who are undocumented, who are being abused, who are not having proper access to care, whether it's healthcare, you name it. And for the party to just make it a non-issue is very problematic, and I was very disappointed. And I was, you found me live tweeting about it on Sunday, complaining about how I was definitely disappointed and just felt ignored as a community. And again, I want to, I guess,
pivot. Can it be possible that these 11 million undocumented can't vote? It's like,
well, I want to pivot a little bit, and not even like before I address that. And I think, now having worked in two really progressive Latino advocacy organizations, I'm working for Voto Latino, whose mission is to empower and connect the Latino community to get out and vote in 2016, and then the Latino Victory Project, whose mission is to elect more Latinos into political office. I've really gotten to understand how there's a huge misconception about the Latino community, and we are just perceived as a one single issue community, and that's
as a homogenous group.
As a homogenous group who only cares about immigration, and it's not true. We care equally as passionate about income inequality. We care about job security. We care about healthcare. These are all issues that intersect.
It's like you guys are regular Americans or something.
Right. I mean, it's a crazy idea, right? Yeah. It's a crazy idea. Yeah. but for some reason, even our own Democratic Party hasn't seen us as that yet,
right?
Because we are bucketed as an issue, and even the African American community is bucketed as an issue. There's an assumption that
absolutely
that each community only has issues that they care about, and for us, we've been bucketed as a community that only cares about immigration, and
right.
It's definitely not true.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, actually, because I saw a quote today from Bernie Sanders saying something like, "No, I think the Black community and the Latino community should come together with this in addition to the general population."
As if
Blacks and Latinos aren't.
That was tweeted today.
It wasn't tweeted.
Okay.
But yeah, he said it to a reporter. Yeah, I'll try to find it.
Oh my god.
And so, you know, I see things like that, and I'm so discouraged, because I just feel like we talk about the party of inclusion, right? We talk about how this is the only side of the debate that's even trying to bring us to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see things like this, and it's just such a, like, it's such a small quote, and maybe to a lot of people, maybe to white people, it seems insignificant, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I just want people to understand how you feel or how I feel when we hear that quote. There's a general population, and then there's those other people.
Right. I mean, in many ways, I mean, it's very obvious, right? Language is used as a tool of oppression in many ways, and that's just one example of ways that it is. And for us to even be a second thought in policy is problematic, and even more reason why our listeners need to be vocal and join us in this conversation, because it just requires a lot more people to get out and, one, vote, minimally vote, two, organize, and three, tune in and involve everybody in the conversation. But going back to what you said, I think I've found it time and time again really problematic where these candidates, as well-intentioned as they may be, are not really in line with the conversations that we're having on race, on class, on gender, on sexuality, you name it. And that's just one great example of how I think, yes, we give so much credibility for experience, but there's something that is lost with age, right? And I think
that's
what you just mentioned.
Yeah. Well, before I get you guys out of here, we're almost at the primaries, so of course what I'll have you guys do is give some predictions. So first, I want to ask you guys, who wins Iowa? And who wins New Hampshire?
Bernie definitely wins New Hampshire.
Yes.
I agree.
Okay. I mean, he's what, up by, you know, 60 to 33, like we mentioned.
And he's been consistently on top.
And I'm this won't be as bold, but I think he'll win Iowa too.
Okay.
But I think that would just be the beginning of the race.
Okay.
Because I think he has to win in the southern states, which
yeah.
will be, I think the next ones are South Carolina, Florida. I think those will be
yeah.
tougher states now. In the, So I think just because he wins the first two, he's not by any means the clear winner. But the advantage of winning the first two is that because he's going to win the first two, the media spotlight will be on him.
Right.
More people will get to actually know who Bernie Sanders is.
Right.
And that's the thing that Obama used in 08 for
right.
momentum.
After
he won Iowa.
Right,
and just
right,
like
right.
people like,
yeah.
oh. Because the thing is, for many blacks, we actually didn't think Obama could win. So when he won a majority white state, we
right.
were like, oh shit, this black brother can actually win.
Yeah. yeah.
So people no, and people actually started believing, and other white liberals were like, oh, he can actually win.
He's got a chance, yeah.
So I think it's the same thing where I think people are waiting for Bernie, like, can he, and if he can beat her in Iowa and New Hampshire,
yeah.
people across the country will be like, you know what? He can win.
Okay.
And if he can win in those states, I think he's gonna give her a run for her money.
Yeah.
So I think it will be those two and we'll see.
What a time to be alive.
All right, well, guys, I want to thank you guys for being on the Cool for Thought podcast. Where can our listeners follow you guys a little bit on social media?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Berto, B-E-R-T-O, Morales, M-O-R-A-L-E-S.
And unfortunately for me, you cannot follow me. I'm still very old school. I don't have any social
that's
media
fine.
That's relevant.
All right, guys. Thank you for being on with us. It was great, and I hope to have you guys back soon.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Thank you.
I want to thank Fritz and Berto one more time for sharing their thoughts with us and explaining a bit about where the Democratic Party lies in 2016 in relation to young people especially. What are your thoughts on what we talked about? Let us know by tweeting at me at UHREEB or emailing me at UHREEB@gmail.com. As I mentioned in the beginning of the episode, this is only part one of our coverage on 2016. Stay tuned for some different perspectives from some young Republicans, Libertarians, and other voices talking about why this election matters, for our generation especially, and what we absolutely need to know. Moving forward, you guys can expect episodes to drop bi-weekly. We've got some really cool episodes coming up that don't involve politics at all, so if you're interested in hearing more about culture and society from the real young people who make up our culture and society, stay tuned. Thanks again for listening, and remember to give us a shout on Twitter. This is the Cool for Thought podcast, and I'm Arib Khan. Stay hungry.